Please be seated. Good morning. My name is Annette Ziegler. I am sitting as the Chief Justice because I'm her designee when she is unable to be the person presiding out here. So that's why I am in this seat at this moment. Our case that we're calling at this point is State versus Williams, 2016 AP 883 CR. I look at the lineup here and I see that it's a little unusual, so I just want to address that at the outset to make sure we're on the same page. Mr. August, you are going to go for 12 and a half minutes, and then Ms. Shaw, then again for 15 minutes and 15 minutes, right? And then you have rebuttal each. That's because both sides have appellate issues here. And so both sides are having the opportunity to present their side and then respond, and then respond again. So as far as classes that we have here today, Eastbrook Academy High School, are you here? Could you stand up a little bit? Looks like a big group. All right. Well, welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Go ahead and have a seat. Chief Justice Rogensack is the person who will be speaking with you. If you have a chance to stay and hear a few words from her, she won't be talking about the case or any cases that we're deciding, but she'll talk to you about court procedures, the way things work, why we're seated the way we are, things like that, if you have any interest, and you can ask her any questions you might have that are not case related. I'll take a second to introduce the bench to you. At my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. I typically sit next to her in between she and Justice Abrahamson. I'm here today instead of the Chief Justice that you will meet later. To my left, or to the Chief's left, is typically Ann Walsh Bradley. She has decided not to participate in this case, so she is not present today. Then Justice Gableman is next to the seat that Ann Walsh Bradley typically occupies. And finally, on my far left is Justice Dan Kelly. With that, I think we can proceed to the work at hand, and I would ask Mr. August if you would please rise and begin your argument.
My name is Christopher August, and I'm here today representing Mr. Jamal Williams, the petitioner with respect to the resentencing issue. This case involves two very important components of the criminal sentencing process. Number one, the right of a defendant to freely challenge proposed restitution without fear of retribution from the sentencing court. And number two, the right of a defendant to a sentence which is based only on proper and legitimate sentencing considerations. We're ultimately asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and ultimately enable Mr. Williams to the error-free sentencing to which he is entitled. The record in this case shows three things. First, that Mr. Williams' successful challenge to restitution is an improper sentencing consideration. Second, that the circuit court in this case actually relied on that improper consideration in sentencing Mr. Williams, therefore constituting an erroneous exercise of sentencing discretion. And three, the state is incapable of carrying their heavy and substantial burden of proving that that error was harmless. Turning to the first consideration, the existence of an improper factor. Mr. Williams' successful challenge to restitution is an improper factor for two interrelated reasons. First, there is a long-standing principle in our law that we do not punish people for exercising their legal rights. That principle is woven throughout many cases, both from this court and the Supreme Court, as well as federal courts. And this court has applied that to a number of situations. For example, the exercise of the Fifth Amendment, the right to trial, and the right to an appeal.
Counsel, I'm not sure this is punishing him for the exercise of a right, so help me with that. So he certainly has a right to oppose the state's request to impose restitution. Having succeeded in that, however, he then has the opportunity to voluntarily make restitution if he wishes, yes?
That's correct.
Okay. And do we know that the trial court was considering his challenge to the restitution request as part of the sentencing, or his voluntary decision after having won that the dispute, his voluntary decision not to make restitution?
So I think this gets into some of the cases that we see, the distinction that we see between rewarding someone for cooperation or what we would term good behavior versus punishing them for a right. I think the cases are clear that there's nothing impermissible about a court, for example, rewarding someone for moving things along, cooperating with the process, early acceptance of responsibility. But I think the cases are clear that what a court cannot do is take someone's exercise of a right and say, because of that, I'm holding that against you in your sentencing, like the court did here.
I didn't make myself clear then. So I'm making a distinction between his challenge to the state's request for restitution and having won that dispute, his subsequent decision to not voluntarily make restitution. Aren't those two separate things?
I don't see the meaningful distinction, because this court found, as a matter of law, that Mr. Williams did not owe that restitution. I'm not sure how it then collapses back onto, in fact, a consideration that he, in fact, invoked his rights to challenge, and he did so successfully.
Well, maybe something like this. So remorse is demonstrated by doing things the law does not require you to do, right?
It can be.
Right. So you apologize, you make amends, you do what you can to ameliorate the ill effects of your actions, right? And none of those things are necessarily legally required, but it's the point that they're not legally required that goes to the question of remorse, right?
That's correct.
All right. So we've established that Mr. Williams did not have an obligation to make restitution. Yeah?
That's correct.
Okay. So now, why can the court not look at him and say, given the fact that you're not obligated to do this, I'm trying to figure out whether you have any remorse for having done what you did, and here are these funeral expenses out there, and you chose not to voluntarily contribute to that. And that shows me a lack of remorse. Why can't he do that?
I think the issue with that is it is, I think, too fine of a distinction between the exercise of the right and the court's comments in this case. Because I think if we're going to say that someone has a right to make a challenge and then to turn around and say, well, but if you do that, I'm going to hold it against you if you then don't voluntarily agree, it's the same difference as if the court said, I'm going to hold it against you if you don't voluntarily stipulate. I don't see the meaningful difference in this case. I think either way, the court is punishing Mr. Williams for his decision to successfully exercise his legal rights, and in this case, have a legal finding that he's not required to pay that money.
But Mr. Williams, in fact, could have said, look, Judge, I'm not legally responsible for this. I would love to pay it, but I simply can't afford it. Otherwise, I would make that offer. What if he had said that? The court could have taken that into account as a mitigating factor or an indication that he was, in fact, remorseful, in contrast to a quite extensive record of a failure to show remorse.
So I think the issue is that the inability to pay is a proper consideration in the restitution calculus. And in order for us to get to that ability to pay determination, the statute is clear that what has to happen is that defendant has to invoke that challenge to restitution. They're given two options. They can stipulate, or they can invoke the procedures under sub 14 of the statute, which require a hearing at which time they could make the arguments about failure to pay, et cetera. And so I think in that case it would be a different argument other than the legal argument he made.
No, I'm saying let's assume all the facts as they occurred here, that in fact the court finds he's not legally obligated to pay restitution. Couldn't Mr. Williams have said, Judge, even though I'm not required to pay it, if I could, I would. I'm so sorry for what happened. I know it won't make up for the loss of life here, but I'd like to do something to show the victim how sorry I am. He could have done that. That's all I'm asking.
I suppose he could have done that, but I think the record also indicates that he did give an allocution and he did express some remorse, and I think his counsel also made extensive comments about Mr. Williams' remorse. So I think he did express some remorse at the sentencing hearing. He didn't in that specific way that Your Honor highlights, but I think there was other indicia of remorse at that hearing.
So let's assume that he had not made those indications of remorse in what he said. He didn't have any legal obligation to apologize, right?
That's correct.
Didn't have any legal obligation to express sympathy or empathy for the victim or his families, right?
That's correct.
So if he withholds that, is it appropriate for the court to increase his sentence?
I think the case law on this indicates that there's a, I think, very, very fine line that courts have drawn. And I think we see this especially in some of the cases cited by the state, for example, the Burr case, which is talking about this vanishingly small distinction we sometimes make in cases between the exercise of the legal right and some other inference from that, such as lack of remorse. And so I think the cases are clear that there are circumstances where a court can in some way, shape, or form either reward someone for expressing remorse, or they can make other comments about the defendant's potentially demeanor or lack of remorse, but they have to do so in a fashion where it's clear that they're not punishing that person for the exercise of the right in and of itself.
But the person has the right not to say anything.
That's correct.
Okay. And if the court looks at that, at the defendant's exercise of his right to say nothing, and he says, I see in that exercise of your right to say nothing a lack of remorse. Is that inappropriate?
I think that that would be inappropriate. I think the Fifth Amendment cases depend on finer distinctions than I think are at play in the restitution cases, and especially the facts of this case, where what the court, I think, fairly clearly did is say, I am taking into account your failure to agree to a restitution figure, to contest a restitution figure, which I'm finding you do not owe.
So draw the line for me. What is it that the court can consider in determining whether the person has remorse?
I think the court can take into account the I think the court has relatively wide discretion in setting a sentence as far as the defendant's character, their demeanor in court, their behavior in the process thus far, all of those things. But I think what the case law is clear is where we draw the line is when the court is affirmatively linking their judgment with the exercise of a right in and of itself. And it's punishing
But the question of remorse is always going to be linked to the exercise of a right, right? Because you have a right not to express remorse. You have a right to say nothing. You have a right not to be empathetic or sympathetic. You have a right not to make restitution. You have all of these, every single thing that you could line up as a basis for finding remorse or the lack thereof is going to be linked to a right not to do it. It's the whole point of remorse is that you're doing something that's not legally required, isn't it?
Well, and I think this gets back into what we were discussing earlier, in which the cases are clear, in which we can reward people for things that they do that they don't have to do, but the converse is not proper. For example, the defendant who says, comes to the first court date and says, I don't want any further proceedings, I don't want a trial, I did it, I'm guilty, I don't want to put the victims through it. It's, I think, totally permissible for the court to reward him and say, I really appreciate your forthright admission and the fact that you are making this as efficient as possible.
Okay, so is it your position then that you cannot punish someone, you can reward someone for showing remorse, but you can't punish them for not showing remorse?
That's not quite my position. My position is it's not the remorse itself. It's the exercise of the rights and how we're discussing the exercise of the rights. Because obviously remorse is a valid sentencing consideration. We don't dispute that. I think that that's clear in Galleon and the other cases that the court can consider and, in fact, should consider. It's a very relevant consideration. What the court cannot do and what the court did here is it appeared to link its judgments and its decision that a harsher sentence was imposed based on the relatively innocuous challenge to restitution that Mr. Williams made. And I guess that's another point under the facts of this case. I don't see Mr. Williams' actions with respect to restitution as indicative that he lacks remorse. This wasn't a case where he was obstructionist or he was in any way not acting in good faith. And I see that my red light is on, so unless there are...
You can finish your statement.
He was not acting in bad faith. He merely made a straightforward legal challenge politely, succinctly through his attorney, which the court granted. Thank you.
Thank you. Shaw?
May it please the court, Deputy Solicitor General Soap and Shaw for the state of Wisconsin. There are two issues in this case, the DNA surcharge and the sentencing factor. I'll begin with the DNA surcharge. Under a proper application of the ex post facto intent effects test, including the Mendoza-Martinez factors, the DNA surcharge statute is not punishment. Before I get into the details of the factors, and there are four I would like to focus on in particular, I'd like to step back for a moment and make a broad point about how the effects portion of the test influences the intent portion. Discerning intent is an exercise in statutory construction. And if, based on that analysis, the legislature intended the statute to be civil, this court examines the statute's effects almost as a sense check to make sure that the legislature is actually doing what it says it's doing, that it isn't somehow disguising punishment as a civil regulatory scheme, as a sham or mere pretext. This court presumes that the legislature is doing what it intends to do, and that's why we give great deference to the finding of civil intent. We examine the effects of the statute in relation to the statute on its face, and only the clearest proof that a surcharge is so punitive in effect will override that finding and convince this court that a civil statute is actually criminal. Under a straightforward application of the intent effects test, the DNA surcharge statute is not punitive. The surcharge statute was intended to create a civil regulatory scheme, as this court held in Scruggs. Nothing about the text, the statutory context, or the legislative history has changed between that case and this one, so there's no reason to disturb that conclusion. And six of the seven Mendoza-Martinez factors cut in the state's favor. The surcharge doesn't impose an affirmative disability or restraint. It hasn't historically been regarded as punishment. It doesn't come into play only on a finding of scienter. It doesn't promote the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. And it's rationally connected to an alternative non-punitive purpose. Nor does it appear excessive in relation to that alternative purpose. Now I'd like to focus on four factors in particular.
Before you do, counsel, if this is not punitive, then why is the surcharge tied to each count such that one defendant could be required to pay multiple installments of the surcharge just based on the number of crimes that he committed?
The surcharge is tied to each count because the alternative purpose of the surcharge is to offset the costs of the state's DNA-related activities, which are caused by crimes. And it makes rational sense that the more crimes someone commits, the more responsible they are as a general matter for the state's expenses. So that is why...
And that would seem to make some sense if you're dealing with multiple crime scenes. But what about a single crime scene in which multiple crimes are charged?
It's possible that a single crime scene where multiple crimes are charged might entail the same DNA work, but it's possible that a single crime scene that included an armed robbery and a rape and a murder might have multiple items that needed to be tested for DNA. So the existence of one situation where costs exceed the DNA surcharge or vice versa does not undermine the general rational connection that animated the legislature in passing the DNA surcharge statute.
Isn't there a surcharge even if they don't test the DNA and he's already been tested and is already in the data bank? They automatically charge it anyway.
Yes, but the fact
that they don't do anything. The state doesn't do anything.
That's not entirely true. The fact that Mr. Williams did not provide a DNA sample in this case doesn't affect the Mendoza-Martinez analysis because the surcharge offsets all of the state's DNA-related expenses, which include developing profiles from crime scene evidence, developing profiles from suspects and other individuals that investigators want to exclude as a result of investigating this crime, developing profiles from individuals arrested but perhaps exonerated for a crime, matching the profiles obtained from evidence against the known individuals that already exist in the DNA databank, matching profiles from crime scene evidence against suspects, arrestees, and other known individuals to include, and also uploading new individual samples to the databank.
I think your answer is a little sideways to her question. Her question was, the charge happens even if that individual's DNA isn't necessary to sample, right?
That's correct, yes. But the charge goes to offset the state's DNA-related expenses.
And those costs, when you list those costs, and when I was preparing for this case, what it reminded me of was my 6 years as a trial court judge and people expressing surprise at the amount of a speeding ticket. 10 years ago, I think the lowest speeding ticket in the state for going 1 mile an hour over the speed limit was probably about $130 in round numbers. I think that was reflective of about a $25 actual forfeiture, and the rest were all mandatory fees, including a $5 law library fee. And I don't remember what all the other fees are, but all of those are regulatory fees that are imposed and collected by various regulatory agencies and other agencies in Madison. One thing I've been curious about as a judge who for 6 years followed the law in regard to the mandatory imposition of all of the surcharges, when the court orders the DNA sample surcharge, even though, as happened here, well, the guy was a little ambiguous in his response, as I recall, about whether he had actually. There had already been provision of a sample, and the court orders anew the collection of another sample and the associated $250 surcharge. Does whoever is responsible for collecting the sample collect another sample, even if 2 years prior they had collected a sample?
Based on the implementing regulations, the answer is no. An individual within law enforcement checks the data bank to see if an individual has already provided a sample. And if the answer is yes, the individual has provided the sample, no new sample is collected.
Because one of the reasons that I would have thought the multiple impositions of the sample, collection of the sample and the payment, in addition to all the regulatory fees and other fees, would have been justified is as insurance against lost samples, botched samples, contaminated samples, and the like. Does anybody go back to make sure, besides the fact that there's a sample present somewhere, that the sample is viable, that it's in case it ever needs to be matched up to either implicate or exonerate, that it's actually still useful?
The DNA databank does perform maintenance and curation activities. One example is identifying duplicate samples. So it's the state's position that those activities do occur. I'm not sure whether it occurs with respect to the particular individual whose sample is taken, but if their sample is already in the database, at some point someone...
And that's part of those are the activities that the surcharge here goes in part to fund.
That's correct, yes. DNA-related work is very expensive, and that goes to one of the Mendoza-Martinez factors, which is, does the search...
I know you want to get to your factors, but I have one question before you move to the other issue as well. And how do we have to overturn the two cases, Radaj and Elward?
One of the points in Mr. Williams' case is that the provision of a DNA sample does not affect the Mendoza-Martinez analysis. And I believe that was the connection upon which the Radaj and Elward decisions relied, that because the misdemeanants in Elward did not have to provide DNA samples upon conviction, nor Mr. Radaj had to provide additional samples for the three marginal counts in addition to his initial one, those courts did not see the rational connection. But it is the state's position that the rational connection is to fund all of the state's DNA-related activities, not just the activities involved in collecting one individual sample as a result of a conviction. So that reasoning in this case would undermine the reasoning of both Elward and Radaj. And to my earlier point that the surcharge is not excessive, there's no evidence that the $250 per felony conviction is excessive in relation to the average costs imposed by the average felony. As a matter of fact, the state's DNA-related costs exceed the surcharge revenue. In 15-16, the state collected $5 million in DNA surcharges. The kits alone, the DNA kits alone, cost the state a couple million dollars. The state employs 74 DNA analysts and technicians. The state spent another few million dollars to pay their salaries. And that is to say nothing of the other overhead expenses associated with maintaining a DNA data bank and performing DNA analysis on thousands of crime scenes. It doesn't include facilities, utilities, transportation, law enforcement, reimbursing law enforcement for their DNA-related activities. And we have to remember that excessiveness is just one of seven factors, and the Supreme Court has said that no one factor is dispositive, and that the effects that have to be so punitive that they override the clearly civil intent behind the statute in the intent effects test. The rational connection here is, as I said earlier, quite simple. Charging people convicted of crimes, as you were alluding to earlier, Justice Gableman, is something that happens frequently in Wisconsin law. There's the crime victim witness surcharge, which is funded on a per count basis. There's also the crime prevention board surcharge, which is also imposed per count and goes to fund boards, as the name suggests, that want to prevent crime and do activities to promote that end.
I think in his concurrence, Judge Hagedorn set forth 16 examples of crimes where such regulatory fees are collected.
That's correct. And I believe his concurrence was also helpful in recognizing that there's no one-to-one relationship required between the cost imposed by a particular defendant and the amount of the surcharge. I see that my red light is on.
All right, thank you. Mr. Rock.
Thank you. With respect to the DNA surcharge, I want to talk about three factors which I think are interrelated in this case. And that's whether the surcharge promotes the aims of punishment, whether the surcharge has a rational connection to an alternative purpose, and whether the surcharge is in fact excessive in relation to that alternative purpose. Starting with whether or not the surcharge promotes the traditional aims of punishment. I think it's clear that this surcharge does promote those aims because this surcharge is uniquely punitive and uniquely severe.
Why isn't it just as simple as the legislature has made a policy determination which, whether you agree or disagree with the wisdom of the outcome of the determination, that their decision is that offenders who are going to require the existence of a DNA database ought to contribute financially to its existence and maintenance. Why? It almost seems like we're being asked to decide a policy question which the legislature, which number one, we're not to do. But most importantly, the legislature has already made, much as the legislature has said, every speeder in the state, everyone who goes 1 mile an hour over the speed limit ought to be, and I don't know if they increased it in 10 years, I haven't got a speeding ticket, and I haven't been in a position to order any, impose any, but when I left the circuit court bench, it was $5 for the law library. Regardless, I don't think too many speeders up in Burnett County or the other counties I would be assigned to on a regular basis, or even in Milwaukee County, are regular users of our law library. But there it is. The legislature has made a policy determination that speeders ought to help fund the law library. Why isn't this simply a regulatory fee?
Well, I think this gets into the distinction, I think, or the relationship between intent and effect. And certainly the legislature can have an intention when they pass a law and they create a fee structure like they did here, but the Supreme Court has been clear that the analysis doesn't stop there, that we need to look at the effects. And I think what's been clear in this case is that regardless of what the legislature thought they were doing or regardless of how the legislature thought this was going to work, what's happened is that this surcharge has provided a windfall for the state. The state, according to
Your opposing counsel just told us that the expenses, and unless you have something in the record to point us to that would contradict it, that the expenses of maintaining the system far outweigh the fees collected. How is that a windfall?
Well, I think the issue is, as we look at the LFB memo that I included in the appendix to the brief, the DNA surcharge...
Do you know about where? I always feel bad for lawyers who are asked that when they're at the podium. No. I can find it if you don't have it.
I believe it is page 145.
If you get me to the neighborhood, I'll find the address.
As the Legislative Fiscal Bureau memo shows us, the surcharge has been operating at a surplus. We have a surplus of about $5 million. And what's happened is we have a large pot of money, which now there's a discussion of, well, what are we going to do with the money? And should we use it, for example, to fund other things that do not appear DNA-related? And that, to me, shows that we don't really have to ask, well, did the legislature have the right decision or not? It's about what is the effect been of what they've done. And the effect has been that they're collecting a substantial amount of money, more money than it would seem they know what to do with, to the extent that now we're having to come up with alternative uses for this money that are not DNA related. And
I want to congratulate you for pinpointing page 145. That's impressive. Second, can you give me the executive summary? You said $5 million extra.
I believe that's what the current surplus is, crime laboratory and drug law
and
enforcement.
That's on page, 147.
Right. So both those surcharges are pooled into what I understand to be one account, and I believe the current surplus that it's been operating since we've had the new DNA surcharge in place is somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million, and there's been proposals, as are discussed in that memorandum, as to some new ideas about how to potentially divert that money toward other things.
And because I don't want you to get too far afield from your main point, and so I want to bring you back. How does the excess then relate? You were about to say it relates to the effect.
That's correct, because one of the things we look at is whether this surcharge is excessive in relationship to the purpose for which it is ostensibly created. So if the purpose is to fill a budgetary hole regarding the maintenance and upkeep of the DNA data bank.
If what?
If the purpose of the surcharge is to fund a legislative need, in this case, the maintenance and upkeep of the DNA data bank, we look at whether or not there's an actual real connection there, and I think evidence that there's a substantial surplus based on the money we've been collecting from defendants, many of them indigent across the state of Wisconsin, it shows us that this is excessive. And I think it's clear, you know, when we look at some of the other ex post facto cases from other states, how this analysis works. I think a great example of a case that's talked about in the briefs is California versus Alford. I think both parties talked about that case. That case was California had a budgetary crisis. They didn't have the money to fund courthouse security. They had a clear, discrete legislative need, and they decided the way they were going to fill that hole in their budget was by assessing $20 to every filing that was made in courts so that everybody would share equally in that filling that hole.
Does it have to go, though? It seems to me you're requiring a certain, I almost want to say causal connection. It seems to me you would impose on the legislature a certain, dare I say, logic that I'm not quite sure the collection of the fees here in the DNA context must be confined to the administration of the DNA apparatus.
Well,
could they use it much along the lines as there are many hands? Like I say, the law library just stands out, but there are many hands that get the $25 forfeiture up to $130. Could they not, could the legislature, is it not within their policy-making authority to say, okay, we're going to fund the DNA apparatus, and if there's excess, we're going to use it in that black hole called general fund?
Right. So I don't think it's a question of, you know, the legislature's power or the legislature's authority to distribute money within the budget. I think it's using this as an example to reflect back on, you know, because no one's saying that they're improperly, you know, illegally or they're doing anything with the money that they shouldn't do. It's this reflects on the relationship between the cost that's being imposed and the purpose for which we're collecting that cost. And so if we're taking in more money than it seems like we need, then that relates to the Mendoza-Martinez factor of whether or not this is excessive in relationship to...
It wasn't that long ago that the State Laboratory of Hygiene was way behind on their work, and in fact there was a successful candidate for Attorney General who ran on that, and I haven't read anything about it in the newspapers, so I assume they've caught up on their work. Doesn't it redound to the benefit of suspects in cases that the police are investigating? And if the police hone in on somebody, and if there is a first-class DNA database that could exonerate innocent people, and even people who have been incarcerated for a long time. You know, we have lawyers from the Innocence Project from the UW come here and argue from time to time. And what's wrong with having a little bit of extra to try to build it even better? And then I'll stop asking questions because I want you to make your argument, but this is, I guess I'm not seeing the connection that you're trying to make me see.
So certainly I don't think anyone disputes that the DNA data bank is an important thing. And I think the DNA data bank is a good thing to have. It's a good thing to have a centralized system of DNA collection and analysis. And I think you're correct that it does benefit defendants as well as it benefits victims and it benefits many players in the criminal justice system and society at large. But what we're talking about is we're talking about the way in which we're collecting the money for that, and how we're doing that is through an onerous and excessive surcharge that it turns out we don't really need all the money that we're collecting from these defendants in order to fund that otherwise valuable and important tool.
Counsel, let's talk just a second about how we measure excessiveness. So in looking at page 147 of your appendix, there's a table there captioned CLDLE and DNA surcharge fund projected condition for 16 and 17, right? And we see there a projected revenue of $14.8 million, projected obligations of $14 million and change. There's about a $750,000 difference between the two, which is about 5%. Is it your suggestion that because there is a 5% difference between revenue and obligation, that that's excessive?
No, I think the broader issue is the balance that we've continued to carry forward in this fund. We have a surplus. And as I think the memorandum lays out, the legislature is now looking to see, well, what can we do with the money that we've taken from these individuals with respect to the DNA surcharge?
And out of that surplus, how much of that came from the DNA surcharge?
Well, that's the thing that's unfortunately it's not clear because it's slushed together with this other surcharge fund.
Okay. And so what we know is that there's a surcharge of $5 million. We're not really entirely sure where it came from. Presumably some of it could have come from the DNA surcharge. Is it possible that the DNA surcharge has been matching roughly expenses and that the surplus came from the CLDLE?
Well, I think what we also know is that there's been a significant increase in the amount of money that we've been collecting for the DNA surcharge. I do know that based on reviewing the LFB materials and some of the things put forth in the briefs, that there's been a substantial, I think, very clear increase in how much money we're taking in there. As
okay.
to discreetly...
So given the change in the fee structure and all of that, and our lack of knowledge about where exactly the surplus came from, wouldn't it be logical then to just concentrate on what the circumstance is now, look at projected revenue and projected obligations, see that they're within 5%, and then determine whether that's excessive?
I think that that could be one approach, but I think I think it's still excessive in some sense, and I think that, again, as the Solicitor General pointed out, this is only one of many factors that we have to look at. We also have to look at the rational connection, for example, between the surcharge and the alternative purpose. And I think that it's clear that there is a disconnect here. I think as some of the questioning during the Solicitor General's time revealed, there's not really a rational connection. This idea that, well, we need it because more crimes and et cetera, you know, it remains a fact that someone who commits 4 retail thefts and is charged with 4 misdemeanors and assessed 4 DNA surcharges of $200 apiece, they're paying more into the DNA data bank despite not creating any DNA costs in that case than the individual who commits a single cold case sexual assault, requiring us to use the DNA data bank and discover the perpetrator, et cetera. That person's only paying $250 into that data bank. So there's not a clear connection as to why the structure exists in the way that it does, why we're requiring in each and every conviction, regardless of any other circumstances, that this person has to continually pay again and again.
Well,
and
we
again.
Know that we know unless things have really changed in the last 10 years, and I don't think they've changed that much, that the hypothetical you just listed would have been taken care of in plea negotiations 99% of the time, right? If there are 4 counts of retail theft and the plea negotiation is going to achieve a resolution, a typical resolution for that would be a plea of no contest or guilty to one and have the others be read-ins. So as far as having $800 for a misdemeanor, depending on the value of the items, that's going to, in the real world, that would be resolved by plea negotiation.
I see that my light is on. May I
go ahead and answer if you'd like?
I would just point out that the plea negotiation issue, I think, can go both ways, because the high-cost DNA cases in which we might see multiple counts of sexual assault, that could also be amended down and would result in a lower DNA cost that doesn't bear rational relationship there. So,
thank you.
Okay.
I'll briefly respond to counsel's arguments about the sentencing factor. The sentencing court properly relied on 8 facts to conclude that Mr. Williams lacked remorse for his felony attempted armed robbery and to issue a sentence 2.5 years below the statutory maximum. Mr. Williams fled from the scene after the shooting instead of calling authorities. Mr. Williams continually minimized his role in this offense. He focused his remorse on his own family, not the victims. He began criminal activity at the age of 12 and continued to reoffend. He escaped or absconded 3 times from supervision. He blamed others for some of his past crimes and at times appeared proud about avoiding responsibility for his criminal activity. The 2-step test that this court uses to determine whether a sentencing court actually relied on an improper factor comes from the Alexander case. Step 1 entails explicit mention of the improper factor, which we have here, but that is not enough, or we allegedly have here. The 2nd step requires the defendant to show that the factor formed part of the basis for the sentence. It's the state's position that Mr. Williams fails to show that his failure to contribute voluntarily to the victim's funeral expenses was a factor that formed part of the basis for the sentence. In fact, the only support Mr. Williams has for his position is a single sentence, and it's the state's position that a correct reading of that sentence indicates that the court...
What was the sentence?
The court stated, "I don't think I have authority to order the restitution. Had you been convicted of the felony murder, party to a crime, certainly yes. But the nature of the attempt armed robbery doesn't justify the restitution or give the authority." It's a very long sentence. "And I think the fact that you're not willing to join in on that also reflects your lack of remorse under the circumstances. And I'm certainly considering that."
So what's the bad part of that statement? If you had to advise the judge before you were his law clerk, you were to advise the judge as to what to say at sentencing, what would you have changed in his statement?
I think perhaps instead of using the word "that," just restate the antecedent, which is lack of remorse. I think that would have made it perhaps clearer that that word "that" referred to lack of remorse, but regardless, it's the state's position that a correct reading of the sentence means that the word "that" referred to the last antecedent, which is lack of remorse. The sentencing court's use of the words "also reflects" suggests that the court had already by that point concluded that Mr. Williams lacked remorse. And indeed, Mr. Williams' lack of remorse was a theme from the very beginning of the sentencing proceeding.
Now, this remorse went to restitution, didn't it? Is the ultimate factor here that he was unwilling to stipulate to restitution?
I don't believe so. I think that the...
But isn't that the argument?
I think Mr. Williams does make the argument that this was somehow the dispositive...
He wasn't willing to do any restitution. He wasn't willing to pay for any of the funeral expenses. That shows he wasn't remorseful. And so when the trial court refers to remorseful, it's saying, in effect, you weren't remorseful, and I know that because you did not make restitution. But he wasn't required to make restitution.
It's the state's position that it was the failure to contribute voluntarily to the funeral expenses, as Justice Kelly was, his questioning earlier, suggested. And
The failure to contribute voluntarily, which would have been a kind of restitution, suggests no remorse. Is that the argument?
It's the state's position that a correct reading of the sentence is only referring to the sentencing court only considered his lack of remorse. But even if the word that referred to Mr. Williams' failure to contribute voluntarily to funeral expenses, as the court's earlier discussion indicated, a court can punish, not punish, a court can take into effect, take into account lawful conduct in setting a sentence. For example, if a defendant at sentencing exercised his First Amendment rights to say that he was not sorry that he would commit the crime again, he does have a legal right to make those statements, but a sentencing court does not go awry in taking those statements into account in setting a sentence. And a number of the cases that we cited in our brief, Burr, Kennedy, Mikos, show how courts may lawfully consider a defendant's lawful conduct as part of their lack of remorse or poor character.
Well, a defendant has a right for a trial, goes to trial, refuses to plead guilty, goes to trial. Can trial court in sentencing say, hey, you went to trial, in 20 minutes the jury came back saying you're guilty, and so you've cost the state a lot of money, spend a lot of time and effort of the state and the jury, and I'm taking that into account in sentencing you?
A sentencing court cannot punish a defendant solely for exercising their constitutional right, such as the right to a trial by jury. And by looking at the transcript, by looking at the exact words that the judge used when mentioning the allegedly improper factor, is one way a reviewing court can determine that the sentencing court used the lawful conduct or the exercise of a constitutional right in the proper way. This court must also look at the transcript as a whole, whereas here, Mr. Williams' lack of remorse was mentioned multiple times in the proceeding before this allegedly improper factor came up. It suggests that not only was that fact not relied upon, but if it was relied upon, it was used in the proper way, in a way that courts allow such lawful conduct to be considered.
Counsel, I'm trying to figure out the proper lens through which to view this, and I'm wondering if perhaps this might be the way of doing it. We look at the sentencing factor of remorse or lack thereof. That's the factor that the court's looking at. And then it's casting about for evidence that either supports or goes against that factor. And so the decision to not voluntarily pay restitution is a piece of evidence that goes into whether the person is remorseful. Is that the way of looking at it?
That's one way to conceive of it. I think the eight facts that I began with support sort of eight building blocks, eight pieces of evidence that support the factor of lack of remorse, which we've all agreed is a proper sentencing factor. And a fact that is considered to support a finding of lack of remorse could be thought of as a ninth or tenth building block in concluding that a sentencing factor, lack of remorse, was present. That's certainly one way to think about it.
Now, counsel, Mr. Williams was convicted of attempted armed robbery as a party to the crime, right?
That's correct.
And this resulted from an incident where he and a co-actor went to a drug deal, and on the way over, a plan was hatched whereby they were going to obtain not only the drugs, but whatever cash the seller had on the seller's person.
That's correct.
And it wound up with Williams, co-actor, firing a shot into the victim, which killed the victim in front of the victim's three-year-old daughter. Now, the restitution that we're all talking about here I don't remember the exact number, but all things considered, it struck me as a relatively modest amount, $974 or something like that.
$794, yep.
Oh, $794. What was that for, a headstone or burial fee or something?
Funeral expenses is what it was characterized.
All right. And then we get to the expressions of remorse, and you touched upon some of the things the judge considered, but as I understand it, a pre-sentence investigation was prepared here by the agent, by the same Department of Correction agent who had dealt with Mr. Williams on several occasions in the past. And the report said, Williams stated that after the shooting, the first thought that entered his mind was that he had messed up his parole. When the agent asked Williams about the shooting of the victim, Williams repeatedly asked what that death had to do with his case because he had been convicted only of the attempted armed robbery of the victim. Williams also said that although he was innocent, he pled guilty to the reduced charge because that was better to going to trial on felony murder. The agent emphasized that Williams had shown, quote, an atrocious lack of remorse, end quote, and that he had been concerned only about himself, his brother, and his son, although when prompted, he had indicated that he felt bad for the victim's father and his daughter, the three-year-old who saw the father get killed in front of her, who had been forced to watch her father being killed. Now, my question to you is, does the state agree that the circuit court judge lacked the authority to order the restitution at issue in this case?
Obviously, the state did not cross-appeal that issue, but we do agree with the Court of Appeals' conclusion that restitution, that the court did have the authority to...
Well, the thought occurs that in an armed robbery situation, for the armed robber, death is certainly the trump card that they hold in order to compel and force their will upon the victim. That's sort of the leverage they hold. Armed robbery, obviously, it's foreseeable. Seems just on an intuitive level without going through some significant legal analysis that when an armed robber presents the instrument of death and tries to compel someone to give up the money or give up the marijuana or both, as the case may be, that the trump card they hold is, if you don't, you are going to die. And if that person gets killed, presumably, there will be funeral expenses. It doesn't seem that unforeseeable to me.
That sounds correct. And the precipitating cause, I think, is the language that some of the decisions about the causal nexus between the act and the restitution, that's the language that they use. And certainly Mr. Williams, who set up the drug deal and drove his brother and himself to the drug deal where his brother had the weapon you're discussing and someone did lose his life, those seem to be, as you said,
and that's where the plan was hatched between the two. Now, there was phrased as the brother announced the plan, but certainly there were many last clear chances for Mr. Williams to. Anyway, please continue.
And
well, before you do, since your orange light is on, as I understand the discussion so far, it's been agreed that you think remorse is an okay factor for the sentencing court to consider, right?
That's correct.
Good.
So is the law.
But that, at least under this case, the failure to pay restitution might be evidence of remorse, but you can't use failure to pay restitution in sentencing here in this case.
It's not the state's position that you cannot use failure to pay restitution. It would be the state's position that...
In this case, can you use failure to pay restitution for sentencing?
In this case, it just happened that it was the failure to voluntarily contribute to funeral expenses.
Right.
that the sentencing court properly considered as relevant to a lack of remorse factor, assuming, of course, that you read the sentence differently than the state does, where the court
referred
to this. I
understand that. So the circuit court should not have said that.
I don't think there's anything problematic about the court's language. I think that...
Why are we here?
What was the question? I'm sorry.
Why are we here?
If everything is okay about what the circuit court said, why are we here?
It's the state's position that the sentencing court properly said...
I know, but the
correct
position of the defendant is that it was not proper. Right?
That's right, yes. Mr. Okay. Williams alleges that the sentencing court relied on an improper factor.
And this refusal to voluntarily pay restitution, could you use that in sentencing?
I see my red light is on.
Go ahead and answer.
Okay. The Seventh Circuit, for example, has said that allowing victims to bear the loss of crime, which sometimes takes the form of failing to contribute to funeral expenses, is relevant to a lack of remorse. And the state would agree with that position, that allowing an individual who passed away as a result of a set of events that you contribute to set into motion can and sometimes will reflect poorly on your character.
Thank you, counsel.
I think the main thing to keep in mind in this case with respect to sentencing is that there is a very careful border we patrol with respect to a person's invocation of their legal rights. We take it very seriously in our legal system that someone should not have their legal rights used against them, that we should not punish people for exercising their rights. I think Justice Hugo Black in a 1957 United States Supreme Court case said that makes sense because the value of the right is diminished if, in fact, we're just going to turn around and we're going to punish the person or use it against them at some later point in time.
So what's the right here that the defendant used that's being used against him, in your opinion?
It's his right to contest the restitution and, first of all, have invoke the protections and the robust restitution procedure that the legislature, in its wisdom, has set forth. The legislature has put forth a very specific mechanism by which restitution is determined. And I think it's clear that, as I pointed out in the briefs, this decision of whether or not restitution is owed is in many ways distinct from and operates on a kind of different track from some of these other sentencing questions we've been circling around. I think
you have been making the point about a fine distinction. How about a very clear distinction? He contested the restitution and he didn't pay it, and he saved his $794. He didn't have to pay it. His right was vindicated.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
But the issue is then that the circuit court turned.
The circuit court, do you disagree with any of the circuit court's recitation on the record of the sentencing factors, of the circuit court's paraphrase of the Galleon factors at sentencing, the nature and gravity of the offense, the need to protect the public, the character of the offender, and then secondarily the need to deter future activities. Do you disagree with the circuit court's recitation of the Galleon factors?
May I answer?
Yes.
Respectfully, I don't think it's relevant what other considerations here were talked about, because when we're talking about improper factor, we're talking about did the court use something that the court was not supposed to use. The fact that the court might have talked about something else in addition that it was permitted to talk about doesn't mean that this improper error is somehow done away with. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your arguments today.
Two and a half minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, it's a little screwy because it's not usually back and forth and back and forth and back and forth again. It's just usually back and forth and back and forth. Sorry.
And they are each arguing a different
right
issue, which we should try
don't take
and avoid
it personally
in the future.
You know, one thing that's been going on unspoken here is what is the nature of the right we're talking about? The defendant has a statutory right to contest restitution. And then now all of a sudden during this lengthy oral argument, I've been hearing questions from the bench from some members of the court about the right to silence, which a constitutional right. As we all know, there is a world of difference between the analysis we apply to constitutional rights, which are rights that the founders said are enshrined, rights that are granted to each individual by God, and that are merely recognized by the Constitution, as opposed to a statutory right. What is the state's position in regard to the nature of the right as to the restitution issue we are talking about here?
I don't know that Mr. Williams has shown that the statutory right to contest restitution rises to the level of a constitutional right.
Okay.
And if I may take a moment to clear up some of the information about the excessiveness of the DNA surcharge and refer the court to some specific pages in the filings. So there is evidence that the state's DNA-related costs exceed the revenues from the surcharges. On page 147 of Mr. Williams' appendix, it says that the state collected $5.043 million from the DNA surcharge. On page 11 of the state's reply brief, we cite LFB paper 409. On page 5 of that paper, it shows that DNA kits cost the state $1.6 million that year. As I mentioned earlier, the state pays 74 DNA analysts and technicians, and although that salary information isn't in our filings or in the record, it is a matter of public record, and the state is happy to supplement with that information, but it exceeds a few million dollars. And that alone, 1.6 plus the $3.5 approximately million dollars that we pay our salaried employees, to say nothing of equipment, facilities, utilities, overhead transportation, far exceeds the $5.043 million that the state collected from the DNA surcharges. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
2.5 minutes goes fast, doesn't it? Okay. All right. Thank you for your arguments. We are adjourned. The court will meet at 1:30 in conference to discuss these cases. And if it wasn't clear, Chief Justice Rogan-Sack is not participating.